If you enjoy this podcast, please like us on Facebook and follow us on Instagram and visit our website at lifebetweenthevines.com.
Great neighborhood. I mean, yeah, we're right here. We've got, like you said, Inglenook just to the north. We've got the J.J. Cohen Ranch, our friends at Scarecrow just here to our west. Phelps is right across from us, Greer. Yeah, so really good people, good neighborhood, a fun area to be in.
Discovering and tasting wine shouldn't be a homework assignment. And we believe that the people who are closest to wine have the best stories. So open a bottle.
And welcome to podcast number 551. This week we feature Trevor Durling, chief winemaker at Beaulieu Vineyards, Napa Valley. Talking with Trevor Durling, chief winemaker at Beaulieu Vineyards in Napa Valley, was like talking with an old friend. It's great to see the excitement on his face while talking about BV's history. I was even given a special behind-the-scenes tour of the winery that has been on Highway 29 for many, many years. The history goes deep, and the space is like a funhouse of wine. You'll likely never see the ghosts, but many people have left their mark on this winery over the decades. Listen to Trevor on our Vino Lingo segment defining the term WWAD. Oh, I'm in a fun place today. I'm truly in a happy place. I am at Beaulieu Vineyards, and I am here with Trevor Durling. He is the head of winemaking and all-around nice guy. How you doing, Trevor?
Thank you, Ray. Well, I'm doing really well. It's a pleasure to be here with you today.
Same here. Thank you. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
We are in the famous building right off of 29 in Rutherford. This particular room looks like at one time it was a cellar. Now it's more of a tasting-ish space.
Exactly. Actually, we're in the most historic part of the winery that dates back to 1885.
Wow.
Now, Beaulieu was actually founded in 1900. The building was originally built by a California senator named Seneca Ewer. And De La Tour didn't actually purchase the building until 1923, which of course was well into Prohibition.
Sure.
And the reason that he purchased this spot, well, there were really two reasons. One, he ran out of space at his original winery because of his success making sacramental wine. But two, the railroad used to go right in front of this building. And so logistically speaking, it made a lot of sense. And so the winery has been expanded significantly since then. But this is still, we're right in the heart, right in the core of the original winery right here.
Yeah, you mentioned that last night about Tom Rinaldi complaining about the railroad tracks. For our listeners who know Tom Rinaldi, the ever famous great Tom Rinaldi.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, my mentor in the business. So, you know, Tom, of course, was the founding winemaker of Duckhorn and then hired me in 2009. Hewitt, which I still make today. And the story I was telling you last night was actually a time when he was riding, he's a big cyclist, right? And he was riding his bicycle north on Highway 29 and took a huge stumble on the train tracks that were right here and came and pounded on the door and asked them to remove the train tracks, right? Because it's not being used anymore. And the response from the general manager at the time, and they're now good friends, was, well, Tom, that's a great idea, but who's going to pay for that?
Right.
And now, of course, the train tracks have been removed, but they lasted for many, many, many decades, and it was very easy for De La Tour to roll barrels right out of the cellar and onto the rail cars, which went down to San Francisco for bottling and distribution.
At your doorstep, you can't ask for more than that.
Right.
Yeah. Boy, you know, this is a question I love to ask people when we're in old buildings. So tell me, are there any ghosts around here?
You know, there have been stories of sightings. I personally have not experienced anything paranormal, but there have been a lot of incidents. Well, I'll tell you one thing. It is a bit creepy to be here by yourself at night.
Yeah, I'll bet.
You think about the history that's gone through this place, and you know there have been a number of incidents with, you know, lab personnel in the past, and you know, cellar employees and people like this that have claimed to have seen some paranormal activity. So there definitely is a let's call it a special energy about this building, but I have not personally ever witnessed a ghost.
It's fascinating to think about walking in the same places, the same footsteps as people who had been here in the 1800s.
Yeah.
It's crazy. But something I like to point out to people, we are here in the year 2024. I'm sorry. We are here in the year 2023.
You're seeing into the future already.
It's okay. No. I don't even know what year it is. But we're being watched 100 years from now. Yeah. You're more so because of your tenure here.
winemakers, as I've said a million times, you live in the past, you live in the present, you live in the future. That's unique as well as a challenge. Do you think about that much?
Every day.
Yeah.
And I consider myself to be so very lucky to be the steward, essentially, of this place that has been, so significant in terms of its importance to the history of the Napa Valley, right? I mean, this is quintessential Napa Valley.
Yes, it is.
We've had some legendary winemakers who have set foot on this property and have come through here, and I talk about this with my team every day. You had mentioned, the fact that if we go back to the 1800s, which we talked about this particular building, there's actually a room upstairs with chalk marks on the ceiling that go back into before the turn of the century.
Wow.
Which is crazy. So it used to be a barrel cellar upstairs. And back then, there were pyramid stacked barrels, and the guys would be sitting on top of the barrels, filling them or racking out of them or whatever it was, and they would actually document the date and the time on the ceiling.
Oh, funny.
Piece of chalk when they would finish it.
Sure.
They're still up there. That is the one room that has been preserved. We've got them going back to the turn of the century. It's absolutely incredible that it hasn't been sprayed off since then. So you can just feel that history when you walk through this building. And then, of course, you have figures like André Telischef, for example, who really revolutionized the way that wines were made here in the valley. And, this was his home.
Yeah.
It's a big responsibility.
It's scary.
Yeah.
Yeah. The sense of history in Napa is sometimes not really thought of because, the western part of our country seems to be thought of as a newer part, but it's stunning what happened in Napa over the couple of hundred years.
Yeah.
And people don't realize this.
I mean, so much change. And you think about, at the time that George de la Tour purchased his original property in 1900, there were more plum trees and walnuts in the Napa Valley than there were grapevines, which is something that I always find so fascinating. I mean, he really got his start, he's from Bordeaux originally, moved to the United States in the early 1880s, landed in San Francisco, and he had a business called California Tartar Works. And what he was doing was he was traveling from his home in San Francisco up to primarily Sonoma, but also the Napa Valley, and he would get to know the local vintners, and he would scrape off their tartrate crystals from inside of their tanks, which was just being a waste. It was a wasted product before. Well, that's cream of tartar, right?
Yeah.
So he saw this as an opportunity. Well, what if I go and I talk to these guys that are making wine, and I say, hey, I'm going to enter your tanks, and I'm going to clean them for you. You just have to let me keep the tartrates. And he did that, purified them, bagged them into 100-pound bags, and he sold them, which is heavily used in baking, right? And this is how he built, this business that he was able to sell in 1900 and purchase property. My point in that is that during that time, he had this affinity towards the Napa Valley. And I think that was for a couple of reasons. First and foremost, the terroir. He was able to accurately predict that, no, this is an extremely special place. And one day, this is going to show up on the world map of winemaking. Secondly, logistically speaking, Napa Valley opens up to the San Francisco Bay in the south. So he was thinking logistically that, hey, I bottle my wines, I roll barrels out on the rail car, as we talked about before, or whatever, and it's very easy to get them down to the bay, load them onto ships, and ship them out. So he was always forward thinking. But at that time, there were very few grapevines that were actually planted here. And to see where it's come today now is just absolutely incredible.
Yeah, a lot of change and more change to come, of course, as time goes on. Where are you from originally?
So I was born and raised in Sonoma County.
Oh, no kidding.
Which, of course, you surprise, surprise, that I'm in the wine business, right? Although it's quite interesting because I do not have any direct family members who are in the wine business. Ironically, my father spent the majority of his career in the beer business, which made me a really popular guy in university, first of all, because I could supply a lot of beer to all my buddies. And ironically, we do say this as winemakers, that it takes a lot of good beer to make a great wine. Don't ever trust a winemaker who does not enjoy a frosty beer. At the end of the day, after tasting a bunch of wine, you want something that's gonna neutralize your palate. It's crisp, it's cold, it's fresh, amazing. Okay, now that being said, my family are still to this day very much wine drinkers. And so, it was a part of my culture growing up. Growing up in Sonoma, you kind of take it for granted, right? You've got grapevines everywhere. I'm just used to this. But we would always have wine at the dinner table. My parents are collectors. They were pretty cool when I was a kid in the way that they would let me, have a smell that, honey. What do you smell there? Maybe have a little taste. Okay, that's enough. Pull it away from me. But I would talk about it from a very young age, and it was something that always intrigued me. I love to cook. I have always loved to cook since I was a kid. And wine is something that was always really special to me because it's present at the dinner table. It's typically surrounded around, you know, I'm experiencing it with loved ones, and there's great storytelling that goes along with it. And it's a whole, the food and wine culture was just very much a part of how I grew up. Now, interestingly, I did not consider it as a professional option, actually, until I was already a student at UC Davis. Hmm. And without going too deep into the story, my original plan was to go to the Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs. I know, complete diversion.
I'd say that.
Now, the reason for that is I grew up extremely close to my maternal grandfather, who made it to 95. He just passed away in 2020, actually, an amazing life. But he was a World War II veteran, started in the Army Air Corps, and then what became later on the United States Air Force, and he flew B-52 bombers during the Cold War. And, you know, he was my mentor in life, let's say. I grew up very close to my father and my grandfather, and, you know, we had a really tight-knit family, have a very tight-knit family, but he was my hero. And I grew up going to air shows. He taught me to play golf when I was a young teenager. He also loved wine. You know, I wanted to follow in his footsteps. And so I had gone through the whole process. I had applied to the academy, done everything, gotten into it, all this amazing stuff. And for whatever reason, when I was a senior in high school, I got somewhat cold feet. And the reason for that was, you know, it's going to be a 10-year commitment minimum if I do this. And I'm probably not going to have the same college experience that I would if I went somewhere else and blah, 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 blah. So UC Davis, I had applied to as a backup school. However, I joined the ROTC program at UC Davis. So I was still doing the Air Force thing, but I'm like, okay, well, I'm going to go here. It's going to be a little softer. I'll have a little bit more options later on. And when I was a freshman year, when I was a freshman during my undergrad at Davis, I took an intro to winemaking class because turns out UC Davis has a phenomenal winemaking program. And I thought, well, I love wine. Let me take this class. I get to taste wine in class. I get to learn about the history. Are you kidding me? It's a no-brainer.
Yeah, it's a no-brainer. Yeah.
So I took this course, and this was the first time that a light bulb went off in my head. And I thought, wow, I've never actually thought of wine in this manner, in terms of I could actually build a career out of this. And so that following summer, I got a job at a local winery called Sonoma-Cutrer Vineyards out in Russian River Valley. And this was through a connection that my mother had. She had a friend who was owned a catering business, became good friends with the guy who was the winemaker at the time, the great Terry Adams, who took me under his wing. And I worked that vintage. My job, probably still the coolest job I've ever had in my life, was a grape sampler. So I would, this is funny. So the only part that sucked about this was I had to show up at 5:30 in the morning. And you're 19 years old, that's not awesome.
No.
Anyway, I would show up and I would meet with the vineyard manager, and he would show me a map. This is before Google Maps and all that stuff. And he'd say, all right, here's your blocks. I want you to sample. I want you to be back by 10 a.m., not 10:01, 10 o'clock. Mm. And you need to have samples of all these blocks. And so here's the keys of the truck. You've got an ATV in the back. I would drive around to different vineyards. I would ride around on an ATV, and I would pick berry samples that represented the particular block, bring them back to the laboratory, have them all labeled. I would show up in the lab, we would smash the grapes up, pour the juice into a beaker, and then run chemical analysis on it, right? So you're looking at basically sugar content, pH, titratable acidity, blah, 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 blah. We would put this in a spreadsheet, which would then get submitted to the winemakers, and I got invited to then go into the room with the winemakers, taste, you know, 100 juice samples. It all tasted the same to me at the time. But I would listen to them talk about when they wanted to harvest each block. And this was intriguing to me because I got to see the behind the scenes.
Yeah.
Then I would go out into the cellar, and this is where I was driving a forklift around, I was pumping wine from barrel to barrel, I was operating a 20-ton bladder press. It was just absolute heaven for me. And I thought to myself, wow, I don't really want to do anything else with my life. So I went back to Davis that following year, and I converted all of my attention towards taking the prerequisite courses to get into the viticulture and enology program, which I ended up doing, and have been making wine ever since.
How many vintages so far for you?
20.
Wow.
I know. I'm dating myself.
You're a young guy.
At 20. Well, thank you very much. It's I do color my beard a little bit, and I drink a lot of wine. But no, it's wine does keep you young, man, as you know.
Question.
But
no, Robert Mondavi, I mean, yeah. He lived a long time.
I know.
But and Mike Gergich, I mean, 100.
Yeah. Well, he's about to celebrate his 100th birthday, right?
Or did it was April, I believe.
It was April. Okay. Yeah. They're
yeah,
doing the celebration.
Actually,
they're doing the celebration in a few weeks. I know that. That's amazing.
I think it was April Fool's.
No way.
I can't swear to it, but I think it might be. We'll have to look that up.
Well, that's a cool. My birthday is April 8th, and I was supposed to be born on April 1st, and I'm very disappointed that I was not, because that would have been the best.
Oh, that would have been too much. Yeah. You just had so much fun with that all your life. Yeah, I get that. I want to go back to something you mentioned, which I find very interesting, is tasting juice.
Yes.
We really have rarely talked about that on the podcast, and having had that experience only a few times in my life, this journey you go on as a winemaker to understand what you're tasting in this juice and through its journey to the point where it becomes bona fide wine, young wine, that has to give you an incredible mental library with a lot of file cabinets, for the most simple way to put it.
Yeah. No, that's a very good point. And so I want to be clear that when we're making harvesting decisions, all that stuff that I described around, you know, running the wet chemistry and everything, that is just an indicator for when you need to get your butt out into the vineyard and actually taste the grapes themselves. So part of it is, okay, what does the juice taste like, right? How sweet is it? What's the acidity look like? Blah, 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 blah. But the other part of it, particularly when it comes to red wine, is you need to actually chew on the skins, and you need to think about, you know, what are the flavors that are coming out of the skins? What are the phenolics that are coming? What are the tannin profile look like? How easily are they degrading in between your teeth, right? When you chew on them, do they dissolve easily? If they do, right, there's enzymes in your saliva that's going to break that down. That's an indication of ripeness, okay? Physiological ripeness. When berries are ripening, you've got a couple different things going on. You've got the sugar accumulation and the drop of acidity, and you also have the phenolic profile. The best vintages are when those two things are lined up. When you have a heat spike, let's say, the phenolics will probably stay here, and all of a sudden you have a spike in sugar, right? That's not ideal, nor is it if it's too cool.
Sure.
You want those things to be in line.
Yeah.
I say all of this because it is extremely important to understand your phenolic profile when making a harvesting decision. And all of our decisions are made out in the vineyard, actually. Chewing on the grapes, man.
As it's always said, wine is made in the vineyard.
It certainly is. Yeah. I always tell our guys I'm joking, of course, but I say, look, you guys, we're doing all this in the vineyard. We're growing the best grapes possible. Your job is, once it hits the winery, just don't screw it up, okay?
Yeah.
There's a little more to it than that, but we like to live by that motto.
I think that's been said before. That's one of my old favorites. Was a song by Mark Knopfler, Don't Crash the Ambulance.
Could you imagine?
Ah, no. BV originally began in what year?
1900.
Okay, so this obviously, again, has this stunning history. A lot of wines have gone through here, but we should look at today, where we're at in the year 2023, to make sure I say the correct year. Is it possible for you to walk through a list of the wines you're making currently?
Oh, absolutely. So our wines that are, you know, out there across the broad market, let's call it, actually many of them available internationally, would be Georges de la Tour Private Reserve. That is our icon, our flagship. It's a wine that we've been making since 1936. It's actually bigger than BV itself. This is an incredibly important wine in terms of the overall history of the Napa Valley. I'm sure we'll get into that a little bit more later. Then we have our Rutherford Reserve Cabernet Sauvignon, which I call Baby George. I love to give our wines nicknames, but this is a slightly softer version of Georges de la Tour, essentially coming from our vineyards on the Western Rutherford Bench. Rutherford dust all day long. That's what that wine is about. Then we have a wine called Tapestry Reserve, which is a Bordeaux-style blend. This is a wine that we've been making since 1990. The beauty of this wine is that I have full artistic freedom, so it's not labeled as a specific varietal. It's a red table wine.
Sure.
And that's really cool because in years where, you know, let's say the Cabernet Franc, for example, is out of this world phenomenal, there's nothing that tells me I can't use as much as I would like in the blend. So it's really meant to be a story of what Mother Nature's given us for that particular growing season. Five main Bordeaux reds, Cabernet Sauvignon based, Merlot, Malbec, Petit Verdot, Cabernet Franc. That's what makes up Tapestry. And then we have our Napa Valley Cabernet, which essentially utilizes the majority of our estate grown vineyards throughout the valley, with the exception of our vineyards down in Carneros, because it's a little bit too cool.
Sure. So what is your total acreage that you're farming here?
We're farming 1,100 acres across the Napa Valley.
How does your brain not explode? That's a lot to keep track of.
It's a lot, but it's amazing because honestly, well, first of all, roughly half of that is located right here in the Rutherford District, okay? So that is our anchor point. That is our claim to fame. These are our most important vineyards. It is the core of George de la Tour Private Reserve, for example. But we do own vineyards all the way in north in Calistoga. Actually, that vineyard in Calistoga is our largest single vineyard at about 340 acres. For all of you history buffs, that was actually a former Christian Brothers vineyard that BV, then owned by Hubline, purchased in the 1980s. They kept the vineyard, and they ended up selling the building to, you know, what is now Greystone, right? The Culinary Institute. Right. That was the Christian Brothers Winery. That is actually the vineyard that is responsible for the majority of the fruit going into our Napa Valley Cabernet, that and Rutherford as well. And then all the way in the south, we own a couple of vineyards in Carneros. So we do make little amounts of Pinot Noir, Chardonnay. We are, I'm going to let the cat out of the bag, we're actually going to be bringing back our sparkling wine.
We talked about that the other night. That's pretty exciting.
Yeah, it's something that, you know, I'm very passionate about. Actually, Madame de la Tour, who, by the way, after our founder, George de la Tour, passed away in 1940, she ran the place until she passed in 52 and then went down to her daughter. She would traditionally greet her guests with sparkling wine. And so this was a big part of our history. In fact, almost 50 years of sparkling wine production here at Beaulieu. Since, you know, 2000, let's say, that program has not existed, but we are bringing this back because I am personally on a, what should I call this? I'm hell-bent to bring back a lot of these amazing historic wines that we, you know, we're making for all these years, dust them off and reintroduce them and tell them, you know, fresh lens, make them, bring these stories back, dust them off and tell them in a new and innovative way that captures the hearts and minds of new wine drinkers. Because there's so much history here and there's all these stories that have kind of been put to bed for a very, very long time.
Sure.
So it's this cool, connection or contrast between that retro feel and contemporary. So you're taking these cool historic stories and you're dusting them off and you're telling them in new ways. So that's really fun. Sparkling wine. I also love to drink this stuff, so this is going to be a lot of fun.
Well, I think that more people are drinking sparkling wine, and I think men, according to what I've been able to study, is that men are drinking it, but now it's being more accepted, and it's a great palate cleanser. We talked again about this last night. It's such a great way to start a tasting with a Pet Nat or with a sparkling wine, with a champagne, and it's fun.
It is fun. Nobody's ever going to, you're not ever unhappy drinking a glass of champagne. Right, I love this stuff, and I better because my wife is actually from Champagne, so I'd be crucified if I didn't like it. But it's just an incredible thing, and you know, many of our vineyards down in the Carneros district are planted to the correct clone of Chardonnay in particular to produce these wines.
So you need to take advantage of that.
We need to take advantage of it. So that's really exciting. And you know, the other thing that I'll say about Carneros, actually, one of the coolest wines that I've ever tasted in my entire life, this will blow you away. It was a 1945 BV Pinot Noir.
Really?
Believe it or not, Andre, first of all, you know, Burgundy lover. Yeah, so Andre was actually one of the early pioneers of the Carneros district. He convinced the De La Tour family to actually purchase land down there, okay? And he loved this stuff. And so it was just this beautifully made wine. I actually drank it with my direct predecessor, Jeffrey Stambor, when he had retired. And we went out to lunch at Trevina. You probably remember Trevina in St. Helena.
Yeah, right.
It was right before they closed down. And he busted out a 1945 Pinot from BV. And I'm going, what the hell is this? I didn't know they made Pinot back then. He said, yeah, it was recorked in the 70s. Came out, saw him, comes out, opens the thing up with an Osso. I think that was before the Durand had come out, I think.
Yeah.
But anyway, he was sweating bullets because he was like, oh my God, this thing, you know, the cork's starting to crumble over. And this thing was singing still. I could not believe it. It was still fresh. One of the coolest experiences I've ever had in this business.
I think that's one of the great experiences with wine. You had mentioned George Latour before, and we should kind of go down that rabbit hole for a moment. What are your thoughts on this particular wine? Oh my gosh.
Well, the wine itself is a legend, right? This is something that, of course, it is our flagship at Beaulieu, but it's also, historically speaking, an incredibly important wine for the Napa Valley in general, right? It was basically the first wine to come out of this region that was accepted as kind of a first growth offering out of the United States, period. First vintage was 1936. We have just released the 2019. So let's see, carry the two, that would make it the 83rd vintage, right? Consecutively. And the way that it was first created was, you know, keep in mind, 1936, right? This is after Prohibition had ended. De La Tour had now become, you know, quite a bit older. He wanted to pass the winemaking reins down to somebody preferably trained in Europe who could, you know, really raise the bar in terms of quality. He saw the quality potential here, sure. Right? So he hired André Telischev, who we spoke about earlier, out of the Pasteur Institute in Paris. André landed here in 1938. One of the first things that he did upon his arrival, other than, you know, revolutionizing the way that wines were made,
yeah.
Things that we take for granted today, yeah, seriously, right. You know, frost control in the vineyard, using known strains of yeast, for example, to complete fermentation successfully, the importance of sanitization in the winery, using smaller French oak barrels, that kind of thing, really was introduced by André in a major way. But what he started doing was he actually tasted through the 36 vintage, which hadn't been bottled yet. So back then, they were holding all of their wines for a minimum of 2 years, often three, in these big redwood vats, okay? And then they would then, sometimes they'd go down to a puncheon size or whatever, and then they would bottle.
Mm.
So he realized that 36, there's some incredible quality here. And De La Tour, his boss, had this vision of crafting a flagship for BV. And so they aligned on that. André selected his favorite lots, and he kept them aside for an additional year, brought some barrels over, went down to barrel in those, and et cetera, and blended and ultimately bottled in 1939 what would become the first vintage of Georges de La Tour Private Reserve.
Mm.
When they bottled it, it didn't have a name yet, okay? So they were bottled as what's called shiners, which is basically a naked bottle with no label. They didn't have a name for it. A couple of months later, in early 1940, unfortunately, our founder, Georges de La Tour, passed away. And this made it an easy decision for his widow and Telischev to name the flagship in his honor, which is why it's called Georges de La Tour Private Reserve. The first vintage was not released until 1941. Prior to its release, it was entered into a wine competition that was held on Treasure Island, just outside of San Francisco, as a part of the World's Fair. And it was tasted by an international panel of judges who had never seen anything like this in terms of quality to come out of the region. And they're looking at each other going like, oh my God, the Napa Valley is really, they're not messing around. This is some pretty cool stuff. And from that moment on, boom, you now had a new benchmark and standard to come out of the entire region. By the time, you know, it was released in 1941, it had gained some really great press and all of that, and it went and it became the official wine of the White House. So you're coming to visit the president from a foreign land, you're probably being served Georges de La Tour Private Reserve. And so it became really that the pride and joy to come out of the whole region. And so to have, you know, the opportunity and the responsibility to get to craft that wine,
oh, yeah,
again, be a steward of a place like this, is such a blessing. And you know, we enjoy the hell out of it every day. Cool thing is, we're using essentially the same vineyards today that were being used all those years ago. So you taste back vintages and you have this core of consistency, which is that Rutherford terroir. It's still there to this day.
You swim in a fun world.
But yes, we're very, very fortunate.
One last question before I wrap up, and you know, are there any really old bottles still floating around here? Some, oh, I love that.
How do you know? Well, destroying another battery here, because I'll go on in this story for a very long time. But we do. We have bottles going back. We do have a couple of bottles of the 1936 vintage, as well as bottles older than that. Actually, some of the original Sacramental wines from the 1910s. The reason that we have all of these wines is because Telischev actually had a secret library at the winery that nobody knew about until 2013. And the reason that he started this was when the daughter took over, her motto was to really, and this was in 1952, would have been, she wasn't really holding back library wines. They were basically selling through everything. And André said, well, you know, we need to keep some of this library for future use and reference and blah, 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 blah. So I'm going to build a cellar that nobody knows about. And so literally, it's still there to this day. You go up to the old laboratory, which is decommissioned. You go into the old coat closet where the lab coats were hung. There's some stairs that are probably not to code today with a it's not used anymore. Trap door up top, there's a padlock. Andre and the facilities manager had the key to this thing.
Oh, wow.
And if you were to open it, you would be in the attic, right? There's insulation, there's, you know, what the hell, why would you go up there? The boiler's up there. You go to the back of that, there's a carve out in the wall. You open the door, that's the tower, or the Telischev library. It had an air conditioner, don't worry. And this is why all of these wines have been preserved for this long. So we have an incredibly unique and fruitful, let's say, winemaking library, which is awesome from a historical perspective.
I just, that's a great story. That's a really great story. I'm assuming they've been moved to a more secure
location. They certainly
have.
A, we outgrew it. And B, you know, we wanted a little bit more consistency in terms of temperature control. And I wanted to make sure we didn't have a catastrophic event where, you know, you lose power and then bye-bye all of your wine in a hot summer day.
So. Just too horrifying to even think about. Yeah. But it's great to be able to have that history. It is history books in a bottle.
It is.
Yeah. My favorite question to ask in these interviews is, you've done plenty of media, you've done interviews, you get to talk to all kinds of different people, both in the industry and people who come into tasting
rooms. First interview, Ray.
Yeah. Yes. Well, I've been too nice to you. I think we'll start again.
Yeah.
You know? But the question is, what is the one question that you've never been asked that you would like to be asked?
The one question that I've never been asked that I would like to be asked. What is the best wine that I have ever had in the world?
You've never been asked?
I've actually never been asked that question on an interview.
Really?
I've never been asked that.
I'm now asking that question.
It was a 1981 Domaine Romanée Conti, which was the coolest friggin' experience that I've had in this business. And I just happened to be, I actually had it in Burgundy, amongst a flight of a number of DRCs, which I, you know, didn't feel worthy, certainly at the time, of even tasting in the first place. But we were visiting one of our longtime barrel coopers, and the owner of this particular cooperage, longtime Burgundian family, he couldn't speak English. I can't speak French, but we both speak Spanish, so we were speaking Spanish.
Oh, how funny!
And that was kind of funny,
yeah.
Right? And he found out, "Oh, you've never tasted Romanée Conti." And I said, "No, man, I'm not made of money. Like, I have not done this, and I'm really in my career." And he goes, "I'll be right back." By the way, we're having dinner at their house, so it was already having a great time. We had all these amazing Burgundies. He goes down to the cellar and he comes back with 6 vintages of DRC.
Oh my!
I'm not kidding. And I almost had to say, "Okay, let's hold the phone." And then the guy next to me, "Shut up, man! It's cool." He opened all 6 of them. We went through this flight. It was the coolest freaking experience ever. Especially listening to him talking about the wine and all of this stuff. And then we've basically finished these. But by the way, there were, you know, probably 16 of us at this table. So it wasn't like I took them down myself. But we finished those, and he's about to go down and get more. And we're like, "No, we can't. I don't think we can taste at this point, you know." And then he comes back with Armagnac instead.
Oh.
But that was just, I think it was a combination of the wine itself, which was just legendary, as we all know, but also the experience and the people that I was drinking it with.
So. You hit on a great word, and that is, in my mind, this business is about experience. The experiences you have, as a winemaker, the experience that people like me get to have talking to you, as well as tasting your wine.
Yep.
Trevor, this has been great being able to spend time with you today and hanging out last night, which was great. But the most important thing for our listeners, what is your website here at Bulio?
It is www.bvwines.com.
Which is a lot easier than trying to spell it, although it's not that hard to spell.
It's not too bad.
It's been around.
B-E-A-U-L-I-E-U, right? But it's easier just to say BV Wines.
Totally agree. Trevor, thanks for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thanks so much. Cheers.
Cheers. Learn more by visiting bvwines.com. Thanks for listening. Subscribe to the podcast at lifebetweenthevines.com or sign up to our YouTube channel. You can also follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Life Between the Vines comes to you from Fifth Floor Recording Company in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Produced and edited by Ray Pfister. Our host is Kay Pascoff. Our web geek is Dan Geisha. Original music by Ray Pfister. Copyright 2023.